Welcome back to the second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome. And if you are a new listener, I just wanted to let you know this is a two-hour show in which we balance the creative with the intellectual and try to explore whether we have more in common than divides us. And we do this by featuring thought-provoking conversations in our Out and About feature, on the street interviewing people in the first hour of the show on a different topic each week, and in this, the second hour, by having in-depth conversations with inspiring special guests from the arts. And if you'd like more information about the show, you can go to the website itsaquestionofbalance.com. There's podcasts of all previous shows there. I've had some great guests and some really interesting topics as well. So again, that's itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing Michael Wirtz, author, illustrator, and printer. Based in Oakland, California, Michael creates images for books, products, designers, ad agencies, musicians, publishers, and movie trailers. His images start with a pencil and finish as digital collages, monoprints, letterpress prints, and screen prints. His clients include the San Francisco Chronicle, The Bark, Bill Graham Presents, Campervan Beethoven, Camelback, Chronicle Books, the DeYoung Museum, the Elsewhere Philatelic Society, the Exploratorium, Farrar Straus Giro, Jinko Press, Hosteling International, McCann Erickson, Oaklandish, Random House, Rickshaw, Bagworks, The New York Times, Nike, The Oakland Museum, Scholastic, The SF MoMA, United Way, and Wired. Michael's work has been recognized by Communication Arts, American Illustration, and the Society of Illustrators LA. With a BA in French language from UCSC and a BFA in illustration from California College of the Arts, Michael is currently back at CCA teaching for the illustration department. Michael is the author of the delightful illustrated book Dog Days and co-author with poet Betty Franco of A Curious Collection of Cats, A Dazzling Display of Dogs, and the recently released A Spectacular Selection of Sea Critters. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you very much, Ruth. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, it's lovely to have you. And I wanted to ask you, I'm wondering if you remember the first encounter with art of any kind that you had that gave you a sense of art not being just entertainment, but also something that can really affect us on a deeper level.
I think, well, to be quite honest, I think the first time I was really wowed by a piece of art was at Disneyland. And the very first time I went to the Haunted Mansion and got on those little doom buggies and started riding around and saw the kind of specters floating around on glass, I think I kind of got a sense of what art could be and how it could affect you. I was so entranced. That and then the other ride, which was kind of similar in a way, which was the Adventure Through Inner Space, which had you kind of shrink down in these little buggies to like microscopic size, and Orson Welles was narrating the whole thing. So there were certainly pieces of visual art around the house when I was a kid. My aunt Carrie did these felt collages, a lot of different pieces of felt. This was like the early 70s. Yeah. Mm. So she made these incredible and very sweet kind of wall hangings for us, and she actually made a living doing it. And it was all these flat colors, kind of like color forms toys for kids.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, that I felt that was also kind of equally entrancing. I would just sort of sit and look at her felt collages. And so I think that was a huge influence on me.
Yeah, it's interesting that both the Disney things you mentioned are about being transported into different perspectives, which of course is one of the things that good art does.
Yeah, and I just loved this, the humor of it. You know, that it was like, it was kind of scary as a little kid to go to the haunted mansion.
Oh yeah, totally.
But at the same time, there was the real charm and brightness to it. You know, as scary as it was also just like entrancing. So I think that kind of got me on my way in a way, because I would then, I had the record, the soundtrack to the chilling thrilling sounds of the haunted house,
and my little
brother and I would like bring it out every single Halloween, put it on, and then draw haunted houses. So that was my first, you know, piece of real art that we just line the hallway in, you know, my house where I grew up, and with these like these funny little houses with like bats and of course, you know, ghosts and whatnot.
Uh-huh. And also, of course, you know, the very important willing suspension of disbelief, that you know what you're going into isn't real, and yet if you throw yourself into it, in a way, it can be as real as reality.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, so I guess there's something, Linda Berry is one of my favorite artists, talks about this kind of world that you can create on the piece of paper, that she would sit and watch her little brother draw these like armies and battles and whatnot on pieces of paper, kind of like script, and then he would like make a bowl of cereal and then get out a red pen and just like scrawl over the piece, you know, this like really carefully constructed piece of art he had made, that he would just like draw all over really quickly. And then at the end, he would throw the piece of paper away, that it was not, the experience was about being, you know, in that piece of paper, like being in that world. It wasn't so much about the final product. It was about the experience.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. So when did you start drawing yourself, you know, starting to feel you could venture into this area of art?
Yeah, I was not one of those kids that was drawing from age five, like, you know, like most, you know, artists you talk to was like, well, I had a very early calling to do this. You know, aside from the haunted houses, I can't really remember pieces of art I did. I think, you know, I drew a little bit when I was in high school, just I think in the margins of my notebook, but I wasn't really on that track until in my early 20s. I decided to follow the footsteps of my older brother, Jeff, who also went to the California College of the Arts, which at the time was called the California College of Arts and Crafts, which was, you know, it's here in Oakland, was based on, you know, the arts and crafts movement of the early 1900s. Mm. And they've since dropped the last C, so now it's just California College of the Arts. But
is that because crafts are now considered art, do you think?
I think because people don't remember or realize what the arts and crafts movement is about, and so they when they see the word craft, they think scrapbooking, or, you know, they think just glitter, you know, which is fine by me. I love like any kind of like something you sit, you know, sit do with your hands, you know. But no, the arts and crafts movement, you know, was of course that, you know, it involved lots of different kinds of beautiful, beautiful crafted pieces, from, you know, glassware to woodwork to all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And CCAC was at the heart of it. So so now they kind of changed the name to reflect the times.
Interestingly, one of the hotels at Disneyland is in an arts and crafts style.
Is that right?
Yeah, I'm forgetting which one now, but
I haven't been to Disneyland in many, many years. And I think, I don't know, there was something kind of just like goofy and pure about it in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And then as soon as they started, like, you know, tried to like make a bunch of money and like throw a bunch of star on top of it, it got less interesting to me.
Yes, I could see that. I think also when you're young, it's definitely a different experience than...
For sure, for sure. And not to say that I won't be back. I do love the place, and I love like how it's so smart. Like all the buildings are kind of at 3/4 scale to make the kids less nervous. There's actually a little tiny version of Disneyland here in Oakland.
Really?
Called Fairyland. And it's right at the shore of Lake Mary. And it's been around since the 1950s. And actually, Walt Disney visited Fairyland And got the inspiration to make Disneyland from it. It's very homespun. It's sort of a storybook land. And it it kind of has these keys. It's got these little storybook, these boxes. And you, you're given a key when you walk in the gate. And so when you're a little kid, they're like, you know, they're these tiny little boxes. You can put a key in and turn. And it tells you the story of, like, you know, Rapunzel or, you know, Cinderella or whatever. And it's just, it's such a great little place. It's really homespun. I actually just brought all students there to do their final project. So I'm a great fan of this place. And if you haven't been, you have to have a little kid with you to go.
Right.
Typically. But if you have a little kid handy, it's a super fun place to go.
Is this Fairyland, did you say?
It's called Fairyland.
Fairyland, right. Yeah. Oh, well, I'll just have to look that up and get a small child to go with me.
Yep. Yeah, you can borrow one from a friend.
Yeah, my boys are too old now. But so you went to California College of Arts, but prior to that, you did do a degree in French. So I was just interested in what took you on that little, I don't know if it was a detour. I mean, it's a detour now, but it probably wasn't at the time.
I desperately wanted to go to college, and I wanted to go and do something I felt like I was good at. And one of the things I was good at in high school was language, and the language was French. I had a an exchange student come from France named Mikael, and he spent a summer with my family, and then I went out to France when I was 16, and I have a love of that place and of the language and of the people. And so when I went to college, it just felt like a natural transition for me.
And then the
choice at the end of that degree was, well, you can go to grad school and you know, read a whole bunch more of these sort of difficult, you know, French poems. Or you can, you know, try and get some kind of teaching job in the Bay Area. So that just wasn't really going to do it for me. So I took some time off, did a ton of, like, waiting tables and whatnot, and then kind of tripped on the idea of going to art school.
Interesting. And that was partly inspired by your brother, you said.
Yeah. My whole family is kind of arty. I mentioned my aunt. My older brother went to CCAC. My older sister is a graphic designer. She used to manage the design department at Esprit, the clothing company. So in the late 80s, that's where she was. And I was, you know, kind of kicking around and doing temp jobs one summer. And so she had me come up to San Francisco for some summer work, and I worked at Esprit, so I got to see what a design department really looked like and what they did, and it was great. Tables full of color, full of people kind of like earnestly, you know, working away at these details to make this clothing line happen. Really interesting stuff.
And
a beautiful space. It was just a big open kind of brick, beautiful space. Lots of really interesting women working there, mostly women, some men too. So both my older brother and my older sister kind of got me started on my way. Also, I have to mention, they had amazing record collections, and they used to bring me out to shows when I was a kid. So that kind of started me on my love of you know, kind of alternative music and posters. My older brother, when he graduated, went right to work for Bill Graham.
So
he was designing posters for them right out of college. He eventually went up to Nike and is still to this day working at Nike. For a time he was working at Bill Graham Presents.
Right. Oh, interesting. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, author, illustrator, and printer, Michael Wirtz. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
About you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, babe, it just goes nowhere.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore, and I've been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my special guest from the arts, author, illustrator, and printer, Michael Wirtz. So we were talking about you being at art school before the break, Michael, and actually I did want to let listeners know, if you're interested in checking out Michael's work, he's got a great website that shows many of the wonderful images that he's created, and also his books at wertzaterria.com, which is W-E-R-T-Z, if you're American, Z, if you're British, A-T-E-R-I-A, so wertzaterria.com. So after you finished art school, I understand you became very interested in silk screening, Michael, and you've said that it melds with your taste really perfectly. So I'm wondering what excites you about silk screening as an artistic medium.
Oh, I just love it. I love, I've always loved flat color. I think going back to, you know, again, talking about the collection of art that my brother had, kind of looking at Peter Max, he was a poster designer and kind of, you know, psychedelic visionary from the 60s and 70s and did a lot of amazing work. And then that my other favorite was, you know, Yellow Submarine, of course. You know, who didn't love that as a kid? And so when I stumbled upon silkscreen in the mid-90s, I just was entranced by the possibility of working with flat color. Kind of, you know, inspired by Hans Eidelman and these people who are just found all this richness and all this depth using very simple color. And I think when I stumbled across it, I stumbled across my friend Flower's shop. She had a little shop called Scary Harry Toys, and she was silk screening in the back. images on fabric and paper. And then in the front, she was selling those same products. So she was making these little dolls, little kind of stuffed dolls and T-shirts and mugs and posters, all kind of emblazoned with these beautiful designs that she was making. And again, very homespun. She had a black tarp hanging over part of the shop. So she was burning screens back there, like stapling the material on the frames, making the screens, covering the screens with emulsion, and just doing everything in-house. And I just love that idea that you can do it all yourself in your house and not have to rely on a lot of technology or a big crew of people to make your work. That it's something that's replicable. Yeah, that's something that you can make a collection of things and if the work is good, you know, people will like it, and occasionally they'll buy it. and so that really, really appealed to me, that I could I could be my own boss and print my own stuff and just kind of work it out the way I wanted to. And that, I think, silkscreen is really lends itself to so many different applications. And so it's still exciting for me, you know, all these years later.
It's always been a bit of a mystery to me exactly what silk screening is. I know you did mention some of the elements of it there. Could you just briefly, for those of us who don't know what it entails, just describe the process?
Sure. Well, you're probably familiar with the work of Andy Warhol.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided that it was he could make fine art using this process that advertising agencies were using for years and years. And basically what it is a screen. It's not silk. It's some kind of like poly fabric that is stretched on the material is stretched on a frame, either a wooden frame or a metal frame. And then that frame is covered, coated with a thin layer of this photosensitive emulsion. And basically you burn your image with a bright light onto that image, and the emulsion hardens. So where the emulsion is cooked onto the screen, the ink won't pass through, but where it's soft, you blow it out with a hose. And you can find lots of demonstrations on this on YouTube if you're interested. But basically you for every color in your image, you use a separate screen. So if I'm doing a two-color image, let's say red and blue, I lay the red screen down. I put a thin bead of ink at the top, and then I use what's called a squeegee to squeeze the ink through the screen onto the paper below. So that is in a nutshell what silkscreen is all about. You're basically just passing ink through a screen down onto some kind of substrate.
Interesting. Oh, well, thank you for that.
Sure. And the way I do it, I actually go even more low tech. I sometimes, when I'm working on a print today and I'm not using any emulsion at all, all I'm doing is I cut a stencil out of paper, just a really thin sheet of 11 by 17 paper, and I'm sticking that to the bottom of an open screen. So if you go down to, you know, your local art store, you can get all the stuff for this and be silk screening in an afternoon.
Wow.
It's not as complicated as you might think. It's really fun.
Yeah. In an interview with Lucy Sisman, you said that in life drawing, students are often taught to draw objects in space from the inside out, to draw bones and muscle mass and gesture before worrying about outline and detail, but that you prefer to go right for the outline. And I'm wondering what it is about this particular presentation of objects in space that appeals to you.
Well, I think that there's just sort of an immediacy to that. I mean, I'm kind of coming at this world of art more from the comic book side of things than the painterly or the, you know, that kind of like watercolor or oil paint side of things, where they're interested in getting a story down on paper really quickly. And the way they usually do that is with paper and pen, right?
Right.
They'll sit down and kind of sketch out their ideas. And that world, you know, thinking about Peanuts, thinking about like even like the Family Circus, that little world is contained in that little circle, that little square. So that I think one of my earliest inspirations, I already mentioned Linda Berry, but Linda Berry is a huge influence on me. And so she talks about wanting to kind of crawl inside that little circle of the comic of the Family Circus and live in that world for a while. I think that's the appeal for me, that there's sort of an immediacy to this.
Right.
And I do feel like, you know, there's a certain limitations to that, you know, to that kind of mode of being, but the silkscreen is nice because there is the possibility for richness, you know, for shadow, for a three-dimensional space, you know, kind of a flattened three-dimensional space.
Yes, yeah. In your collaborations with the poet Betty Franco, the bright, fun pages include the words of the poems integrated into the images in multiple ways, sometimes becoming part of the characters or creatures, other times kind of swirling around them. And I understand that all the lettering is hand-drawn, but not necessarily in the traditional sense, with some digital aspects. So I'm wondering if you can give us some insight into the process of how these images with the words are created.
Yeah, sure. Usually when I work with Betsy, Betsy Franco is the author. Once again, you already explained this, but she and interestingly, she's James Franco's mother. She's just as busy as her son. Like she's got like 100 different book projects going all at once, but I'm lucky to work with her. She sends me, the manuscript as a Word document, and she's got these kind of rough ideas of how she'd like the page to look. And then I go to pencil. So this is just part of being an illustrator, is this sort of these series of collaborations. Yeah. So I'll do a quick sketch, send it off to the publisher, that gets approved, or maybe there's changes. And then the lettering and the illustration is done based on that sketch. So I scan the sketch in, and then in layers in Photoshop, and you mentioned my website, you can see many examples of this on my website. I just basically build the image from background to foreground using just layers in Photoshop and a Wacom tablet. So that's how I'm able to get those nice kind of smooth lines and kind of a hand-done feel, even though it is, for the most part, when I'm working on kids' books, digitally produced.
Right. And what's the appeal of creating the look of traditional methods in a digital way?
Oh, I always like to see the hand in it a little bit. Margaret Kilgallen always talks about, like, even if you're another inspiration, I'm naming all my inspirations today. She always says that even, you know, with something you try, even if you try and get something as exact and as perfect as you can, it gets boring. If it's too slick, if it's too kind of solid and slick and computer looking, it kind of sucks all the life out of it. So I do love a straight line. I love kind of solid shapes, but I also like to get a sense of the artist behind that line.
Yeah. And why are you using digital at all? Why not just use traditional methods? What are the advantages?
Well, I started out doing, when I got right out of art school, I was doing pastels. So like kind of the other end of the spectrum. I really liked, you know, kind of how painterly they were, but also, you know, how direct they were. It's like, you know, it's like having a chalkboard in your studio that you roll up and send to your client. The problem was a couple of problems started to happen. And the big one was that if anyone asked for any changes, again, being an illustrator, you're collaborating a lot.
Yeah.
And that means changes to your artwork. You know, can you move this character over 3 inches? Can you change color on this person? Can you have a go back to the pencil and start again with the composition? I mean, there's all kind of changes that happen in the course of working with a client. And working traditionally, for me, meant starting from scratch. So I'd do these big pastel paintings and then just have to sit down and start again. And working on, and also working as an illustrator means you're working often on really, really quick deadlines.
Right, yeah.
Working for the New York Times often is less than 24 hours. You'll get,
you'll get a call at
12 o'clock Pacific time and have to have a sketch in by 3 and a final by 5.
It's
just a crazy, crazy quick deadline. And so working traditionally at the time was really difficult. I think now there's, you know, now you can scan stuff in at home. It's probably a little bit easier, but there still, just working in Photoshop just allows for really quick changes, quick color changes, and you can really kind of work on the fly.
Yes, yeah.
So that's the appeal for me.
Yeah. I interviewed renowned illustrator Myra Kalman on the show recently, and she said she became an illustrator partly because she really likes working to a remit and having deadlines. And this is in contrast to a lot of artists who hate doing commissions or having deadlines because they feel it sort of cramps their creativity. But as a successful commercial artist yourself, I'm wondering what your relationship is with the deadline and what your feelings are about having a brief from a client.
That's when I really feel like when I get a job, you know, come across my desk by way of email or phone call or whatever, I really feel like, okay, I'm doing my work. I'm really, like, I kind of turn on right then. It is an exciting, moment in
yeah.
for me anyway. It's
a focus, I guess, as well, isn't it? It really focuses you in.
Excuse me?
It's a focus as well. It really sort of, I mean, you know, if you've got like the whole world to create something about and then somebody actually focuses in on something, that's exciting too, perhaps.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly it, Ruth. It's about kind of this sea of possibilities. For me, the limitations, be they like the time limitation, a color limitation, or the limitation of silkscreen, that's really when I feel like I flourish. I just work well with the deadline. Otherwise, yeah, it the linger otherwise.
Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, Michael Wertz. Just to let you know about his website again, it's Wertzateria, WERTZATERIA.com, Wertzateria.com. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, author, illustrator and printer, Michael Wirtz. Michael, you've contributed work to the project Home is Where the Heart Is, with art accentuated within the word heart, which was developed by Oakland-based ad agency Arson. And artists donate their time to create works of art representing animals to be rescued, and then these works go to the new owners when they adopt. And as the adopter of two rescue dogs myself, I was very touched to hear about this project, and I wonder what made you want to get involved.
Like you, Ruth. Yeah, I love the rescue animals. We just adopted another little pit mix. Like 4 or 5 months ago. Her name is Blue. She was our second adopted dog. It's just, what can you say? Those animals need our help. They're so amazing and so loving and so difficult. I feel they really enrich our lives. I don't want to say that they enrich our lives more than, you know, than a dog you might get from a breeder, but I like a dog with a little mystery, a little history. And the Oakland Animal Shelter is the beneficiary of the project.
Yeah.
And I'm actually working up another print for that same project today. So I've got a few of the prints are on my website now on the shop page, so you can take a look at them. I also have a series of greeting cards that are all dogs from East Bay, California, East Bay animal shelters.
Aww.
And they're just great animals.
Yeah.
And the people working there are doing such good work, and they're doing their very best under difficult situations. So
yeah.
I'm always happy to, you know, lend a print if I can.
And there's a show of the works of art, is that right, as well?
If you take a look at Home is Where the Heart Is, you should be able to find, I don't think they've got a time set for the next show that's but it's going to be very soon, and I'll have an announcement about the show on my website.
That's lovely. You're also very involved with the Elsewhere Philatelic Society, and the society's website states, it is an art collective that focuses on the drive to achieve philatelicism, the study of the study of stamp collecting, collectors and collections, an amorphous mishmash of public space reinterpretation, street art, environmental installation, publications, machine augmented concerns, I'm not sure what that means, and philately. So this all seems quite eccentric and charming. So I wanted to ask you to elucidate a little bit what all of that means, and also what inspired you to get involved.
Well, philatelicism is sort of the philatelism is like the study of stamps, and so we're kind of a fake stamp collecting society. What it really is an attempt to get our members away from their computers. As much as I love a computer, I love to get away from the computer.
Uh-huh.
And I love when young people put their phones down for a second.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an attempt to get people out on the streets and looking at art and interacting with all the interesting stuff that the San Francisco Bay Area has to offer. So the Elster Philatelic Society is just that. We set up these, we have a podium, and then I get up and mailman drag. My name in the game, it's kind of a game, we call it a game, is Mailman Mike. Uh-huh. And we offer our members experiences. So we bring them to unexpected, out-of-the-way places. And we have these stamp designs that we offer them, and these beautiful passports that are that were designed by Carolee Wheeler, who made these incredible passports that look just like real passports. They feel like them, too. And so our members have their own stamps. They're given these kind of commemorative stamps for these different places. And the stamps are on my website again under the maps and stamps section. You can see some of the work. But I think I would, if for your listeners who are in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, I think the best thing for them to do is to go to stampsfromelsewhere.com.
Uh-huh.
And there's an application, and the application involves going to San Francisco and enjoying a very interesting hour and a half walkabout that is kind of audio based. And at the end of it, you get a stamp, and then you're on the path to philatelicism.
Like, okay. So you don't have to be an artist to be a member of the society.
Not at all. At all. Yeah, you just have to have an interest. You have to have an interest and feet and some kind of device that will play MP3s.
Right. So it seems like kind of, I know it says it's a sort of mishmash, but it seems like a kind of flash mob with geocaching and kind of just art all mixed in.
We started as basically a fan club to this other alternate reality game. So there's all this stuff online about alternate reality games, but we started as a fan club to an ARG that we were all involved in called the Jejun Institute.
Mm.
And the Jejun Institute was a really complicated art project that happened in the deep forests of San Francisco.
Hmm.
There's actually a documentary about it on Netflix called The Institute, and you can find it, you can rent it, and I'm actually in that documentary for a hot minute.
Best minute, of course.
That will probably explain better than I ever could the kind of weirdness that happened in San Francisco for a time, where people were, like I said, getting away from their computers and kind of not just going to their work and to the cafe and to shop, but out in the streets of San Francisco looking for clues and experiencing San Francisco and Oakland, for that matter, in a totally different way, kind of with open eyes, because you're out with a map and maybe some kind of audio track, and you're looking for clues. You're looking for these connections to these different art installations.
Hmm. Now, and you create some of the stamps, is that correct, with your images?
I do.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to be invited by the Elster Philatelic Society to join as one of their members, and it turns out I'm a bit of a ham, so I'm kind of, I'm one of their spokespeople.
Right.
I didn't know I had this in me, but as soon as I got up in a fake mailman costume, I was quite hammy. So it's been so much fun. We've been doing it for 5 years now, and we're probably going to keep going at it for a long time.
Yeah, no, it sounds like tremendous fun.
We look forward to your membership, Ruth.
Yes, I shall certainly be looking into this. I'll have to do the application process and see how I get on with that. Yeah. Maybe when it's not raining.
Yeah, it wouldn't be as much fun in the rain.
Also, you recently sent off your contributions to the Post-it Show at Giant Robot in Los Angeles, and the show is organized by artists Mark Todd and Esther Pearl Watson, and it features work from artists well-known and unknown in the form of 3x3-inch pieces of work the size of a Post-it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, what is it like creating a work that small?
Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
Why?
I didn't know what I was going to do. I really didn't, because I've been relying on screen printing for so long, and they specifically said no prints. You know, they don't want to see... They don't want to see 100 little post-its of the same print for sale. That's not interesting to them. They want to see handmade work. So what I ended up doing was, and I haven't put this up on my website, but I will very soon show the examples of what I did. I ended up cutting up my prints and making collages out of them. So I started with spray paint and did some stencil, and then... did some color pencil drawings, but then was a little bit frustrated with that as well. They weren't popping as much as I would like them to. So I had some scrap from one of my screen prints sitting next to me, and I just took some scissors to it and started cutting it up and gluing it down on top of the post-it. So it was a really interesting process, a really interesting day. We were speaking just now with Myra Coleman. She and I got to interview her for her latest book, Beloved Dog, at Bookshop Santa Cruz. And she speaks of this state of not knowing, being in a state of not knowing. Mm. When she sits down to work, she kind of empties her mind and gets her paints out and lets whatever is going to appear on the page, kind of unhindered by any preconception or any kind of, any preconception about what she wants the work to look like.
Yeah.
And so I was like, all right, if Myra Coleman were doing this, what would she do? You know, so I just let myself play, got the scissors out and started doing some collage, and it was really fun.
Mm.
So I'm excited to be part of that show. I sent off like 15 post-its. It's going to be at Giant Robot in Los Angeles. Let me see. I'll get the date for you.
December 5th.
Mark Todd was nice enough to ask me to participate in that show, so I'm excited about it.
Yeah, and I understand that people queue up sometimes 12 hours in advance of the show opening in order to have the opportunity to have first choice of the images, which are all $25 each, no matter how famous the artist.
Right. Yeah. No, it's wonderful. It's really something. And it's great to see the photos of all the work up all at once. And, I also love how, affordable they are. They're little, they're affordable, they're meant to move, it's like $25 each. And like you said, some of the artists are really, really well known. And looking online, if you do a search for Post-it Show and Giant Robot, you'll see some past examples of other artists' work. And it's just so great, so varied.
Yeah.
Really, really talented people putting all of their kind of heart into this tiny little space.
Yes.
Which is great.
Yeah.
Linda Berry talks also about if you're trying to write something, if you're trying to write a book, for instance, instead of sitting down to a blank page, if you've got writer's block, or I imagine this would work for an artist as well, don't try and finish a whole page. Don't get a whole 8.5 by 11 piece of paper out. Get a post-it out and just fill that post-it. That's all you need to do.
Huh.
So
interesting.
That is it. I think it's about dividing your work up into manageable chunks, right? So the post-it will allow you to do that because it's so little.
Yes, yeah. And it kind of forces you to prioritize as well, doesn't it? What's important, whether it be a creative, image or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It kind of releases you from that sort of importance, like, I have to make this great piece of art, or I have to make this great piece of writing. It's like, no, you have to make this little tiny thing that might at some point fit into a larger puzzle.
Yeah. You don't have to do it on an actual post-it, do you? I mean, you could just do it on a 3 by 3 inch size paper, right?
Sure. Or you could go and get, you could go get a bunch of those 4 by 6 cards. I imagine that the same would work for that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure this is a trick a lot of your writers already know about, that you just fill up by 4 by 6 cards, and then maybe you put them on a bulletin board and rearrange them to kind of get your story going.
Yeah. No, I meant for the actual post-it show. You don't have to do it on an actual post-it, do you?
You do have to work on an actual post-it.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the only I found this out, it's in this show working. The worry in working on actual post-its is that if you're doing what I was saying, like moving stuff around, like moving your post-it, the gum on the back starts to wear down really quickly.
Oh, so it has to stick on the wall as an actual post-it as well?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
That's how they're displayed, yeah.
Oh, wow. Gosh. Yeah, that's even more challenging then, because they're quite thin, aren't they? So
they are. Well, yeah. I could kind of, like I said, I could kind of like cheat a little bit because I was working with collage.
So you make it thicker, yeah.
I beefed them up a bit.
Yeah, and I saw one online where somebody had even sewed around the edge of the post-it. So I think you can work, if you're creative and you're an artist, you can make it work for you.
Very crafty, those artists.
Yes.
Very crafty indeed.
Yeah. I'm thinking that exhibitions like this draw people into the art world who perhaps otherwise wouldn't be exposed to it, do you think?
That's right. I mean, there's a whole kind of element of the lowbrow in this, and I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of the lowbrow art movement, that it's, in more concerned kind of with pop culture and with the immediate than with these kind of highfalutin notions of what art should be. I think it's really fun. I think it's really great and immediate. Mm. And kind of reachable, attainable for people, not only in terms of cost, but just in terms of kind of the idea behind it, that everyone can participate in this, it's not something you have to be a quote unquote professional to do. Everyone has the ability to sit down and fill a post-it.
Yeah.
I encourage your listeners to try some of this stuff. I encourage your listeners to make prints and make drawings. And Linda Berry says, the meteor could hit tomorrow, do what you love today.
Yeah, no, that is very good advice.
Yeah.
We're coming towards the end of the show. We've got about a minute left. So I just wanted to ask you in that minute briefly, all art is about communication. I'm wondering, is there something you're trying to convey consciously through your work?
Well, the last print I just put up on the shop was the print of Phyllis Diller, and I think, and it was done for a show called The Love of Phyllis Diller. I just want to add some color to the world. Everything's so gray nowadays, isn't it? Like, look at the people on the subway. Everyone's wearing gray and black, and that includes me. So I'm interested in adding a little bit of color to the world, and I think there's nothing more complicated than that. I just I like bright color and want to see more of it on people's walls.
Well,
on their shelves.
Yes. Well, you're doing a wonderful job. Your work is amazing. So you're very welcome. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Absolutely. What a thrill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
So I wanted to let listeners know, again, if you want to find out more about Michael's work, you can go to wertzateria.com. And again, that's wertzateria.com. And you can also get his books from Amazon. And he's got the wonderful Dog Days, A Curious Collection of Cats, A Dazzling Display of Dogs, and the A Spectacular Selection of Sea Critters that just came out. So you can check that out on Amazon as well. And again, his website, wertzateria.com. And his work certainly does bring a wonderful lot of colour into the world. So I would recommend you going and having a look. And also wanted to direct you again to the show's website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can find more information about the show there, about me. There's podcasts of all the previous shows that we have done. Had some wonderful guests and some very interesting discussion topics with people out and about on the street. So you can check that out. And you can also connect with me on social media, should you so wish. Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook. And if you want to email me, it's ruth@itsaquestionofbalance.com. Always like to hear from you. I'll see you next week.